Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Cooper Union and to the Great Hall, where we are going to hear one more in our ongoing series of lectures on the United States Constitution by Professor Burt Newborn of NYU Law School. Tonight's lecture is on equality in the Constitution and the difficult move from formal equality to substantive equality. Let me just remind you that these things get in the way of our all hearing the lecture, so if you've got one, make sure it's turned off. And Professor Newborn.
I want you to know how dangerous this is. I'm getting to feel at home up here. Thanks for coming, and thanks again to Cooper Union and to Lee Islin for giving me a chance to talk about the Constitution in Jay Islin's honor in this wonderful storied space. And I guess it's worth noting that tonight is the 50th anniversary of Channel 13, WNET, which is the other great public institution that Jay Islin played a major role in bringing to prominence. This is the sixth in a series of lectures in Jay's memory. The first five have focused on the text of Madison's Bill of Rights and the characteristically different ways that Republican and Democratic justices have tended to interpret it. We move tonight, in lecture six, at least for tonight, for the moment, away from James Madison's what I will call first Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, to Abraham Lincoln's second Bill of Rights, the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments, enacted in the wake of the terrible Civil War that ended slavery and brought the concept of equality into the Constitution for the first time. The sad fact is that the United States Constitution, including Madison's first Bill of Rights, was born in chains. The literal chains of the 700,000 black slaves it consigned to perpetual servitude, the economic chains of the poor it excluded from the vote, and the social change of women it consigned to an inferior place in society. The luminous idea that all men and women are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, trumpeted to the world in Thomas Jefferson's magnificent preamble to the 1776 Declaration of Independence, was ruthlessly excised from the 1789 Constitution and the 1791 Bill of Rights. The idea of legal equality does not find its way into the Constitution until the adoption of the three great post-Civil War amendments, the 13th, which abolished slavery in 1865, the 14th, which guaranteed all persons the equal protection of the laws in 1868, and the 15th, which banned racial discrimination in voting in 1870. Thus, in our constitutional heritage, autonomy, the dominant idea in the 1791 Bill of Rights, had a 77-year head start over equality, which doesn't formally enter the Constitution until 1868. But even that is misleading, for despite the post-Civil War amendments, the Supreme Court was, at best, lukewarm to the idea of constitutional equality for racial minorities and women for another 75 years, giving autonomy a real-world constitutional head start over equality of more than 150 years. And Democratic justices on the Supreme Court have been trying to close the autonomy-equality gap ever since. And while Republican justices have welcomed equality into the Constitution, they have been less willing than their Democratic colleagues to dilute values of autonomy in order to achieve equality. And that basic disagreement is at the root of most of the differences between the equality provisions of the Republican and Democratic constitutions. And despite the reelection of President Obama and the emergence of formidable non-white, gay, and female political constituencies, we do not live in an equal post-racial, post-gender, or post-sexual orientation society, nor have we dealt with the chains of poverty for fully 25% of the nation's residents. Consider these disturbing statistics about the current state of real equality between and among the races and genders, reflecting the consequences of poverty as well as race in today's America. In 2009, the latest available statistics, the average per capita income for blacks was 57.1% of the white average. Hispanic household income was 48.3% of the white average, and Native Americans earned 52.1% of the white average. In 2009, the median household income of whites was $54,461 a year, while the median household income of blacks was $32,584. Unemployment rates for blacks are consistently at least twice as high as unemployment rates for whites. Largely because of the nation's drug policies, approximately one-third of the black men in the United States were under the supervision of an aspect of the criminal justice system in 2000. Nearly 12% of the black male population in the United States is currently incarcerated. American blacks are imprisoned at nearly six times the rate of whites. In 2009, 12% of whites, 21% of blacks, and 32.4% of Hispanics lacked health insurance. American whites have a life expectancy 5 years longer than that of blacks. The black infant mortality rate is 2.5% higher than the white infant mortality rate. Black infants are almost four times more likely to die from complications associated with low birth weight. And although teenage pregnancy among blacks has decreased more than 45% from 1990 to 2005, it is still more than 2.4% the rate of whites. As of 2003, there were racially correlated disparities in education for grades, test scores, retention, dropout rates, graduation rates, special education, gifted programs, extracurricular and co-curricular activities, and discipline rates. How did we get to such a dreadfully unequal place? For one thing, look at where we started from. Slavery persisted in the United States until Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 and the adoption of the 13th Amendment after a civil war to end slavery that claimed between 600,000 and 700,000 American lives, more American lives that were lost in battle in World War II. Military Reconstruction in the South, which is just a fancy name for military occupation of the South after the Civil War, ended in 1877. With the withdrawal of federal troops from the states of the old Confederacy, the 15th Amendment, guarantee of the right to vote without racial discrimination, simply ceased to exist in the South and in most of the North as well. For the next 62 years, not a single black person was elected to Congress. In 1929, Chicago elected a black congressman who served alone as the only black person in Congress until the 1945 election of Adam Clayton Powell from a Harlan constituency doubled the black presence to two. The Latino story is similar, with the exception of New Mexico, where many citizens of Hispanic origin traced their roots to pre-1948 Mexico. Virtually no Latinos served in Congress until the 1950s, and then only in ones and twos. Jeanette Rankin was the first woman to be elected to Congress, and she was elected in 1917. As recently as 1953, this is the way parts of this country lived. As recently as 1953, the state of Texas forbade interracial boxing matches. In Florida, black and white students were forbidden to use the same edition of a school textbook. In Arkansas, black and white voters could not enter a polling place in each other's company. In Alabama, a white nurse was forbidden to care for a black male patient. Six states required separate bathroom facilities for black and white employees. 6 states, black and white prisoners could not be chained together. In 7 states, tuberculosis patients of different races could not be treated together. In 8 states, all forms of public recreation, from parks to beaches to ball fields to movie theaters, were racially segregated by law. 10 states required segregated waiting rooms for public transportation. 11 states required blacks to ride in the back of the bus. 14 states segregated railroad passengers by race. 17 states mandated racial segregation in public education, while 4 additional states and the District of Columbia permitted it. In 1960, a black family thinking about a vacation had to buy a guide to a local place where they could eat and sleep. Black musicians and baseball players, when on the road, kept lists of restaurants where they could buy food at the back door. Entire categories of employment were closed to blacks. Racially motivated violence directed at blacks was rampant, especially if they sought to vote in the South. Lynchings of blacks were recorded as late as 1964, bringing the shameful documented total to more than 1,500 during the 20th century, and the actual total is probably 4 times greater. Go home tonight and listen to Billie Holiday's recording of Strange Fruit and realize that she is mourning black men hanging from trees. Sadly, it started with the founders. From the perspective of equality, the 1789 Constitution was a racial pact with the devil. The 1790 census reported 3.8 million persons living in the United States. 18%, 700,000 human beings, were black slaves residing in every state but Massachusetts. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration in the Declaration of Independence that all men were created equal, pontificated all his life about equality, but owned 223 slaves whom he declined to free at his death. They were sold off without regard for family integrity to pay his massive debts. Even Benjamin Franklin owned a slave. Franklin planned to free him in his will, but the slave died first. The 1789 Constitution was a bulwark of slavery, resting on 3 pillars: the Enumeration Clause, the Importation Clause, and the Fugitive Slave Clause. Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, which is the Enumeration Clause, provides that each state's representation in the House of Representatives, and of course that means the Electoral College as well, was to be apportioned on the basis of population, with slaves counted as 3/5 of a person. Do the math. In a country with 3.1 million persons, free persons, and 700,000 slaves, the 3/5 compromise awarded the slave states legislative representation in Congress and the Electoral College for 420,000 fictive souls, more than 10% of the population of the nation, who could not vote, thereby assuring that white voters in the slave states would control the House of Representatives and the Electoral College. Article 1, Section 9, the Importation Clause, forbade Congress from interfering with the importation of slaves for 20 years until 1808 to permit the buildup of the slave population to the point where it would be self-sustaining through normal population growth. And the plan worked. The slave population in the United States increased fourfold between 1810 and 1860, eventually reaching 3.2 million persons, constituting a 1.8 million representational windfall under the 3/5 compromise clause, favoring Southern representation in the House of Representatives and the Electoral College. Article 4, Section 2, which is the Fugitive Slave Clause, provided that runaway slaves were to be remanded from sympathetic Northern states to their alleged owners in a Southern slave state for the adjudication of their legal status. Now, the story of the Fugitive Slave Clause begins in Boston in 1769, when Charles Stewart, a British customs officer, purchased James Somerset, an accomplished black household slave. In 1771, Stewart decided to bring Somerset with him when he returned to London. Once in London, Somerset promptly escaped, was recaptured, and placed in the hold of a British ship about to sail for the West Indies, where Somerset was to be sold as a field hand, an occupation carrying a mortality rate of 100%. In 1772, Granville Sharp, the great Quaker abolitionist and the world's first public interest lawyer, brought a writ of habeas corpus on behalf of Somerset before Lord Mansfield in King's Bench. Mansfield ordered Somerset released, ruling that Somerset's legal status was to be decided under British law, which forbade his sale as a slave to the West Indies. Now, Somerset's case can be read three ways. It's an enigmatic opinion. It can be read three ways. Its narrowest reading would merely forbid punishing a runaway slave with transportation to the West Indies, because that would be a de facto death sentence. Its intermediate reading would treat slavery as against British law, permitting slaves like Somerset, who had been voluntarily brought into Great Britain, to seek their freedom by invoking British law while in Great Britain. Its broadest reading, adopted by abolitionists in Britain and the United States, would view slavery as patently unlawful in Great Britain, enabling any slave, including a runaway who managed to reach British territory, to claim freedom under British law. Now, slave owners at the Constitutional Convention feared that Northern courts, deeply antithetical to slavery, would adopt the broadest reading of Somerset's case, enabling a runaway slave who reached a sympathetic forum in places like Pennsylvania or Massachusetts to resist repatriation to an alleged owner by arguing that the law of the free state governed the ex-slave's legal status. The purpose of the Fugitive Slave Clause was to avoid the application of free state law to runaways by requiring the free state court to remand an alleged runaway slave to the alleged owner's slave state courts for ultimate disposition of legal status. And it's painful to me to report that Northern judges, believing themselves bound by the rule of law, sent thousands of escaped slaves back to almost certain death under the Fugitive Slave Clause. It took a bloody civil war of incalculable cost in lives and treasure to end slavery. In the wake of the Civil War, the nation enacted a second Bill of Rights, Lincoln's Bill of Rights, in order to bring equality into the Constitution. In 1865, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery, and sadly, Lincoln never lived to see it ratified. In 1868, the 14th Amendment promised due process of law and equal protection of the laws to all. And finally, in 1870, the 15th Amendment outlawed racial discrimination in voting. Now, despite a fierce political fight, women were not included in the right to vote in the 14th Amendment and were not mentioned, right to vote in the 15th Amendment, and were not mentioned in the 14th. Women had to wait until 1919 in this country for the right to vote under the 19th Amendment. And if you think that's bad, French women didn't get the right to vote until 1946. In 1870, 1871, and 1875, Congress authorized federal courts to enforce Lincoln's second Bill of Rights against state or local officials. But neither the courts nor the country were ready for racial or gender equality. Women were rebuffed in famous cases like Minor versus Happersett, which reject the argument that the equality principle in the 14th Amendment renders it unlawful to deny women the right to vote. And in Bradwell versus Illinois, Myra Bradwell, who was one of the first graduates of the Columbia Law, female graduates of the Columbia Law School, was denied the ability to practice law in Illinois solely because she was a woman, and it was upheld in the Supreme Court because women were really not ready and fit to practice law. Blacks were rebuffed in cases like Plessy versus Ferguson, upholding government-opposed, separate but equal racial segregation. And the 19th and 20th century Supreme Court, and this is a tragic blot on its record, the 19th and early 20th century Supreme Court upheld or tolerated every single technique used in the South to eliminate the 15th Amendment from the Constitution. Violence was tolerated in a case called United States versus Cruikshank, where the court dismissed federal indictments of the leaders of a mob for the murder of more than 100 blacks who had assembled to protect the right to vote. The court reasoned that the federal statute was unconstitutional because the federal government had no power to act against private mobs, a holding that was not reversed until the 1960s and 1970s. It left black people who wished to vote at the mercy of their local police forces. Fraud was condoned in United States versus Reese, which dismissed federal indictments for refusing to cast ballots cast by black voters, because the Supreme Court found that the statute didn't explicitly talk about racial discrimination. In 1903, in a dreadful case called Giles versus Harris, Oliver Wendell Holmes, our Oliver Wendell Holmes, refused to use judicial power to help black voters from being unlawfully disenfranchised in massive numbers throughout the South. The truth is, instead of serving as a monument to Abraham Lincoln, the 14th Amendment was hijacked by a partnership between corporate America and the Supreme Court. Once corporations were found to be persons within the meaning of the 14th Amendment, corporations, not blacks, not women, became the chief beneficiaries of the 14th Amendment. Beginning in 1876, the Supreme Court invoked the so-called Substantive Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to invalidate state and federal legislation fixing minimum wages, maximum hours, child labor protection, and railroad rate regulation. Now, I'll talk more about the era of the so-called Substantive Due Process Clause after Thanksgiving in Lecture 7, when we talk about the role of the Due Process Clause in the Constitution. The long road back for racial and gender equality begins in this room, at this podium, with Lincoln's magnificent Right Makes Might speech in 1860 opposing slavery, the speech that propelled him to the presidential nomination. And with Susan B. Anthony's founding of the Equal Rights Association in this room in 1867, and with Elizabeth Cady Stanton's founding of the National Woman's Suffrage Association in this room in 1869. It's not hyperbole to observe that we are meeting in the room where constitutional equality was born. But the real change in the law of constitutional equality didn't begin until after World War II. In the aftermath of the war, widespread legally imposed racial discrimination was accurately diagnosed as a social cancer threatening to destroy the nation. Some perceived American racism as a betrayal of the generation that had fought Nazism and had sacrificed so much for American ideals. I remember my father and his friends angrily asking each other why they had gone to war if it had not been to end racism. Some correctly perceived legally condoned racial injustice as a genuine and terrible threat to national security. Domestically, the Communist Party was able to expand its domestic allure by highlighting its stand against racism. It was the most popular thing it did. People joined the Communist Party not because they cared about communism, but because it was one of the only organizations that systematically opposed racism. Racial discrimination in the United States also turned out to be a Soviet propaganda bonanza. It quickly became clear that the Soviets were willing and able to use American racism as a powerful weapon in the worldwide struggle for supremacy that we now call the Cold War. Now, the combined force of moral disgust with racism and the potentially adverse effects of racism on national security finally set the nation in motion. In 1947, Jackie Robinson and Branch Rickey integrated Major League Baseball. I don't think you can overestimate the social importance of that event. It was acting out in front of thousands and millions of people, the move toward racial justice. In 1948, President Truman desegregated the armed forces by executive order. He couldn't get congressional authorization, so he did it unilaterally. It's one of the bravest things an American president has done. Also in 1948, the Supreme Court outlawed the enforcement of restrictive real estate covenants. And in 1950, they outlawed racially segregated law schools and blocked the exclusion of black voters from party primaries. And in 1952, in the first argument in Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court began the process of ending legally mandated public school segregation ushering in an era during which the challenge of achieving racial equality was catapulted to the center of the nation's consciousness. Now, Brown was argued twice. It was initially argued in 1952. The argument went very badly. The rumor is that the court was divided 5-4 in favor of upholding separate but equal racially segregated public schools. After an acrimonious set of conferences, the justices finally decided to schedule the case for re-argument during the next term. Now, before Brown could be re-argued, the Chief Justice, Fred Vinson, a courtly Kentuckian who was skeptical of Thurgood Marshall's position during the first round of oral argument, died unexpectedly of heart failure. President Eisenhower quickly nominated Earl Warren, then the immensely popular Republican governor of California, thereby removing Warren as a political rival. Now, Warren was nominally a Republican, but by this time he was endorsed by every major party in California and ran unopposed for governor. Once he was confirmed by the unanimous voice vote of the Senate, can you imagine that? We once lived in a world where a new Chief Justice was confirmed by a unanimous voice vote of the Senate. Warren moved vigorously to secure a unanimous Supreme Court decision outlawing mandatory school segregation, and he succeeded. Although the price was the inclusion of the all-deliberate speed language in the Brown decision that encouraged diehard segregationists to spend the next 15 years seeking to slow the process in the South to a crawl. Now, in what may be an apocryphal story, Felix Frankfurter, who was serving on the court at that point, is purported to have said that the only real evidence of God's existence that he had ever seen was the replacement of Fred Vinson by Earl Warren on the eve of the argument in Brown. The unanimous opinion in Brown invalidated the principle of separate but equal segregation and triggered an explosion of legal energy that eventually dismantled American apartheid. And by the time Earl Warren retired in 1969, Jim Crow was dead. But the judicial energy released by Brown was not confined to racial cases and to ending Jim Crow. It triggered concerns over gender equality as well. As with race, the move to gender equality begins in World War II, when women responded to the nation's massive wartime labor shortages by replacing millions of American men in the workforce who had been called to military service. Now, the largely female wartime industrial workforce, symbolized by Rosie the Riveter, performed superbly. American industry has never exceeded the levels of efficiency and productivity achieved by the female labor force during World War II. And important as that material achievement was, I believe it paled in connection with the shift in female consciousness. Having proved to themselves and to the world that they could perform brilliantly in non-traditional work settings that had once been the exclusive province of men, American women, like the proverbial genie, would never again allow themselves to be put back into the bottle. And I believe that modern feminism in the United States was born not in French manifestos by Simone de Beauvoir, but on the factory floors of World War II, even though it took a generation to burst into full-scale political movement. Now, it's worth a moment to consider the very different experience of Nazi Germany in dealing with wartime labor shortages. They had the same wartime shortages we did. Their men were at war, and they had enormous labor problems in staffing their factories. But Nazi ideology saw women exclusively as breeders and as nurturers of citizens of the New Reich. There was no room in Nazi ideology for Rosie the Riveter. Instead, the Nazis solved their wartime labor problems by using slave and forced labor. By 1943, almost 80% of the German labor force was made up of concentration camp inmates or conscripted workers from the conquered Eastern nations. And the world rightly condemns the unspeakable brutality and moral bankruptcy of the Nazi slave labor system. But as with black slavery in the American South, we sometimes forget that Nazi wartime slavery was also an economic disaster. Staffed with undernourished, unwilling forced workers who resisted at every opportunity, German wartime productivity failed to match American norms. Now, I shudder to think what the world might look like if Nazi ideology had not made it impossible for German women to play the same heroic wartime industrial role as their American counterparts. And it's a lesson worth remembering by those of us who fight for equality, that equality is not only a moral imperative, it is the sine qua non of true efficiency. In 1971, having begun the process of achieving formal racial equality, the court finally turned to the pervasive, legally reinforced social and economic barriers that consigned many women to second-class citizenship. In Reed v. Reed, the first case to declare a law unconstitutional on the basis of gender discrimination, Chief Justice Warren Burger wrote for a unanimous court in invalidating an Idaho statute that automatically preferred male relatives over equally related female relatives in selecting the person to administer the estate of someone who had died without a will. Now, the statute was obviously premised on a stereotypical assumption that the male relative would probably have more business experience than the female relative. The Supreme Court reasoned that it was unconstitutional to base laws on stereotypical visions of a woman's likely ability or appropriate role in society. Reed v. Reed triggered a series of women's rights test cases in the Supreme Court, many of them brilliantly orchestrated and argued by now Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was then a professor of law and director of the ACLU Women's Rights Project. The test cases were designed to attack laws premised on a stereotypical vision of a woman's role in society in an effort to prevent the law from being used to reinforce stereotypes and outdated cultural assumptions about how women should live their lives. Now, for tactical reasons, Ginsburg targeted stereotypical laws that benefited women at the expense of men. For example, in Frontiero versus Richardson, she successfully challenged the military regulation that automatically treated the wives of military personnel as dependents, but required husbands of military personnel seeking dependent status to prove that they received more than one half of their support from their spouse. In Weinberger versus Wiesenfeld, she successfully challenged a Social Security regulation that permitted widowed mothers, but not widower fathers, to claim benefits based on the earnings of a deceased spouse. In Califano versus Goldberg, she successfully challenged the Social Security regulation that allowed widows to obtain benefits more easily than widowers. And in Duren versus Mississippi, she successfully challenged a law permitting women, but not men, to opt out of jury service. And the only case she lost in those years was a 5-4 case out of Florida, Kahn versus Chevin, where she unsuccessfully challenged a Florida law granting real estate exemptions to widows, but not widowers. Ginsburg's tactical brilliance lay in her recognition that an all-male Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor was not appointed, the first female justice was not appointed until 1981, would subconsciously be more likely to invalidate laws treating women better than men rather than vice versa. And her career as a test case lawyer ended in 1980 when President Carter appointed her to the DC Circuit, and 13 years later, in 1993, President Clinton appointed her as the nation's second female Supreme Court justice. In the 1970s, when I served as the assistant legal director of the ACLU with special responsibility in those years for the Supreme Court docket, I remember defending Ruth Ginsburg against angry criticism by ideologically driven ACLU board members who were upset that the Women's Rights Project always seemed to pick on women. The board members just didn't get the fact that Ginsburg was using men to systematically dismantle the legally reinforced gender stereotypes that had led the 19th century Supreme Court to deny women the right to vote and to practice law. Now, fortunately, the disgruntled board members accepted my assurances that she really was a feminist, and they left her alone to carry on her remarkable work. Now, it's really rare, that a lawyer is blessed with the chance to function as a superb tactician in the Supreme Court, and then get the chance to to write the Supreme Court opinion cementing her life's work into the Constitution. Thurgood Marshall had that chance. He argued Brown, and then as the nation's first black justice, repeatedly used the equality principle articulated in Brown to advance racial equality. Ruth Ginsburg was equally blessed. In 1996, 37 years after launching the attack on legally stereotyping women, Justice Ginsburg wrote for the Supreme Court in United States versus Virginia, the ultimate anti-gender stereotyping case that struck down the Virginia Military Institute's refusal to admit women to the state's elite military academy. The ghost of Myra Bradwell must have smiled. Justice Ginsburg's close friend, Antonin Scalia, fumed. The Supreme Court's intense, if long overdue, commitment to constitutional equality for racial minorities and women spilled over into the protection of the legal rights of out-of-wedlock children and resident aliens. Inheritance laws discriminating against out-of-wedlock children were invalidated as unconstitutional. Resident aliens won the constitutional right to practice law and to teach in the public schools, but not the right to serve in the police force. As with women, who lost the challenge to the all-male draft, the Supreme Court was not willing to recognize an equality-based constitutional right to wield coercive force on behalf of the state. And those of you who were present last week may recall my thesis is that is protected by the Second Amendment. And it took another generation to achieve equivalent formal equality for gays. And Justice Anthony Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor broke with their Republican colleagues to lead the way. In 1996, in Romer versus Evans, Justice Kennedy, writing for the court's four Democratic justices, joined by Justice O'Connor, invalidated a provision of the Colorado Constitution forbidding municipalities from enacting laws protecting gays from discriminatory treatment. And 7 years later, in Lawrence versus Texas, Justice Kennedy, writing again for the same six justices, overruled a 1986 precedent, Bowers versus Hardwick, and ruled that a Texas statute forbidding consensual sodomy in private was unconstitutional. With the 2002 decision in Lawrence, the final plank of the Democratic Party's post-World War II political platform that had begun with the 1948 Truman executive order desegregating the military was finally achieved. Formal constitutional equality for the traditional discrete and insular minorities, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, Native Americans, women, gays, resident aliens, and children born out of wedlock that had been the traditional targets of legally sanctioned majoritarian oppression. And we have to recognize that achieving formal constitutional equality in the courts would have been relatively meaningless in the absence of a parallel equality agenda pursued by the Democratic Party in Congress. In the wake of President Kennedy's assassination in 1963, the Democratic Congress enacted much of his proposed legislative program, including Title VII, barring discrimination in employment, Title VIII, barring housing discrimination, Title IX, barring discrimination, including gender discrimination, in college athletics, and a federal ban on discrimination in access to public accommodations like hotels, parks, movie theaters, restaurants, and barbershops. And perhaps most importantly, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was enacted in order to eliminate discrimination in access to the ballot. In addition to suspending literacy tests, Section 2 of the Act replaced the very difficult discriminatory purpose standard that we discussed in Lecture 2 with a disproportionate effects test, making it possible for the first time to challenge numerous allegedly neutral techniques that had frustrated efforts by racial minorities to secure fair legislative representation. And even in even more radical provision of the Voting Rights Act, Section 5 required political subdivisions with historic voter turnouts of less than 50%, coupled with the use of some test or device like a literacy test to determine eligibility to vote, to pre-clear all changes in their election laws with the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice to assure that the new laws were not being used to disadvantage black voters. And the Voting Rights Act coupled with vigorous Supreme Court enforcement of formerly equality voting rules, resulted in a massive upsurge of political activity by members of racial minorities. When the Voting Rights Act was enacted in 1965, there were 6 black members of Congress. Double digits were reached in 1969. The current House has 44 black members, about 10% of the House, roughly proportionate to the black population of the United States. A similar story can be told about Latino registration. Prior to the Voting Rights Act, Latino representation in the House of Representatives hovered at about 1 or 2 members, sometimes none at all. In the years since the Voting Rights Act, 44 Latinos have been elected to Congress and 5 Latinos to the Senate. Women went from a single member of Congress in 1917, Jeanette Rankin of Montana, to 20 senators and 76 representatives in the current Congress. And in perhaps the most dramatic example of the triumph of the Voting Rights Act, the country elected and reelected a black president, Barack Obama, in 2008 and 2012. 45% of the electorate that reelected the president was non-white. A remarkable political transformation in the course of a generation that demonstrates the power of even formal constitutional equality when it's backed by congressional action. So that even formal, it's worth fighting for even formal constitutional equality, because look what it can achieve in a generation. But the grim statistics that I quoted to you at the beginning of this lecture make clear that formal constitutional equality, even when it's reinforced by congressional enforcement, has its limits, especially when it's applied against the backdrop of a social and economic reality that has been shaped by centuries of oppression and discriminatory treatment. Imagine what a relay race would look like if one contestant had to carry heavy weights for the first 3 legs and then was told he could take the weights off in the 4th leg. How often would the newly freed runner catch up? And that's the dilemma of formal, and we have achieved dramatically in what is really one of the great success stories of any culture. Since the Second World War, we have achieved formal equality. Whether or not that formal equality translates into anything meaningful is a question of whether we can deal with the past consequences of discrimination that leave the ex-targets of that discrimination essentially in the place of that relay runner. Everybody else is way ahead, and all of a sudden they've been freed, and the question is, can they ever catch up? It's at this point that Republican and Democratic justices often disagree bitterly about constitutional equality. The consensus constitution stops at the rules governing and defining formal legal equality. Efforts to go beyond formal equality in an effort to deal with the consequences of past discrimination have split the court, and the Republican majority has tended to reject them. The modern effort to achieve substantive equality in the Supreme Court hit a stone wall in 1973 when the majority shifted from Democrat to Republican. And it hit the stone wall in a ruling in a case called San Antonio versus Rodriguez, a 5-4 case with 5 Republican justices, 4 Democratic justices. Upholding a Texas decision to fund its public schools exclusively through local property taxes, even though such a financing technique would condemn poor districts that had a very, very weak tax base, usually made up of citizens of color, to a far lower quality of education than the wealthy white suburbs with a much higher per capita tax base who could afford much, much more pricey educational options. And the 4 Democratic justices dissented in Rodriguez, arguing that if you legally differentially allocate education, that's just as unconstitutional as differentially allocating votes, or differentially allocating, or formally discriminating on the basis of race. And the lineup of the Republican and Democratic justices in Rodriguez foreshadowed the court's approach to a generation of effort to attain real equality by removing the residual effects of past discrimination. If ever a case deserved to be pilloried by Anatole France. You know, in the first lecture, I read you a poem. I read you Wallace Stevens' wonderful poem called The House Was Quiet and the World Was Calm. Let me just read you a famous sentence from Anatole France that really tells us what much of the problem is now. This is from a novel that he wrote in 1894, The Red Lily, La Lily Rouge. The law in its majestic equality forbids the rich, as well as the poor, to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread. Now the question is, can we get beyond that? Can we get beyond the formal equality that we should be proud that we have achieved? Get beyond that formal equality to something about substantive equality. Now, if ever a case deserved to be pilloried by Anatole France, it's San Antonio versus Rodriguez. Ironically, the decision leaves many black and Hispanic students worse off than before Brown. Under Plessy, at least racially segregated schools had to be formally separate but equal. Under Rodriguez, the schools in rich and poor areas will remain racially segregated, but are no longer even nominally equal. And it only goes downhill from there. Efforts to turn a formal ban on legally mandated public school segregation, which is what Brown imposed, into a substantively integrated school system founded on the twin issues of neighborhood schools and busing. And now, 58 years after Brown, in many, perhaps most, northern states, public schools are more segregated today than they were before Brown. In addition to banning busing across urban-suburban lines, the Republican justices applying a Republican colorblind constitution have invalidated efforts to use race as a criteria for zoning and public school admission in an effort to achieve and attain and retain integration. Legislative attempts to turn political systems shaped by years of racial discrimination into substantively equal systems through benign racial gerrymandering designed to increase minority voting power have also foundered on the Republican vision of a colorblind constitution. Efforts to correct for past discrimination in the hiring and promotion of police and fire departments throughout the country have foundered on restrictions on affirmative action imposed by the Republican constitution. Efforts to achieve substantive equality in access to higher education hang by a thread. For years, a bitterly divided Supreme Court has permitted the use of race as one of many admissions criteria designed to enrich the educational experience by assuring a diverse classroom. Even that small effort at achieving substantive equality is now under Supreme Court scrutiny by a hostile 5-justice Republican majority. And perhaps the greatest threat to racial substantive equality is the Supreme Court's decision a week ago to review the constitutionality of the preclearance provisions of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. In 2005, Congress overwhelmingly reenacted Section 5, believing it to be necessary to prevent racial and ethnic backsliding. It would be shocking if the Republican Supreme Court were to ignore Congress's will. The effort to achieve substantive equality for gays also hangs by a thread. Gay marriage will be before the Supreme Court this term, probably, in two contexts: review of state laws forbidding gay marriage, and a review of the constitutionality of Congress's passage of the so-called Defense of Marriage Act that releases the states from a duty to recognize marriages, same-sex marriages, lawfully performed in a sister state. And the outcome of those cases will determine the reality of the degree of gay equality that we achieve in the country. Now, there was, however, and there is, however, one resounding victory for substantive equality: judicial recognition of a woman's constitutional right to control her reproductive life by using birth control and choosing whether to bear a child, Roe versus Wade. The constitutional right to choose is not usually viewed as an equality issue. Roe v. Wade failed to posit a precise constitutional theory underlying abortion rights. Some find the theory in the due process provisions of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment. Some view constitutional privacy, including the right to opt for an abortion, in a non-textual Ninth Amendment right. And I'll discuss both of those a little in lectures still to come. Some even find protection of abortion rights in the First Amendment protection of freedom of association. I find constitutional protection of the right to choose in the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and its implied analog in the Fifth Amendment. In 1992, Justice Ginsburg, then Judge Ginsburg of the D.C. Circuit, delivered the Madison Lecture, which is the principal lecture each year at NYU Law School. She argued that abortion rights are best viewed not through the lens of privacy, but as absolutely necessary to permit women to play an equal role in society. Unless, reasoned Justice Ginsburg, women can control their reproductive lives, they can never aspire to real equality in any culture. No society, she noted, has ever achieved equality for women without granting them control over their reproductive lives. And she was right. Just as the Second Amendment is best read as an egalitarian provision protecting the right to bear arms, the right to an abortion is best understood as the right to decide when and whether to bear a child, without which a woman could never aspire to genuine substantive equality. They will always be competing uphill. Now, please don't understand me. Don't misunderstand me. Bearing children, not bearing arms, bearing children may be much more important socially than competing with men. And to many, it can be much more rewarding. But the only way that a woman can enjoy genuine equality in the game of life is to be permitted to make those choices for herself, not as a matter of hedonism or a matter of privacy or autonomy, but as the only path to genuine gender equality. Now, while the decision to take advantage of a woman's opportunity for equality, granted in Roe v. Wade, involves a terrible moral choice about terminating incipient life, it is a choice that the state cannot dictate if women are to emerge as truly equal participants in a free society. And what the courts have done for women, they can do for racial minorities. It is not too late to deploy the democratic constitution to permit the political majority to engage and use the benign use of race to achieve genuine racial integration, genuine political fairness, genuinely equal access to education, and genuinely equal access to the labor market. As with the right to choose, though, a decision to use race in a benign manner as part of an affirmative action plan to erase the consequences of our racist past also poses difficult and terrible moral choices. Once race is used as a benign criterion for affirmative action in hiring, education, or politics, there will be winners. In fact, maybe all of us will be winners, but surely the favored minority will be a winner. But there will also be losers, guilty of nothing but having the wrong skin color. In effect, affirmative action risks sacrificing the aspirations of contemporary innocent white males, generally, in order to undo the social and economic harms to women, blacks, and Latinos perpetrated by long-dead white men. The question is such a trade-off morally acceptable? In the end, the difficult moral choices about winners and losers in the affirmative action world should, I believe, be left to the people. And while the state, in the guise of the Republican Constitution, should not be permitted to make those moral choices for us, I end this lecture on a cautious note. There is something deeply troubling about forcing an innocent white aspirant to bear the cost of society's need to undo the consequences of our racist past. That is a cost that we should all bear. Accordingly, I believe that our affirmative action plans should consist of providing preferential additional opportunities for minorities and women over and above those that had existed in the past, but not decreasing the opportunities available to white aspirants. That means expanding the available pie, larger college classes to absorb more minority students, more police and firemen to make room for historically excluded groups, and the increased economic costs needed in other contexts to expand the pie. The cost of expanding the pie to make up for past injustice can and should be spread across the whole community. Instead of our current practice of shifting the full cost of achieving racial justice to a few unlucky, innocent white aspirants. And I am convinced that this is not only good moral policy, it is good strategic policy. Because what we have to learn to do in this country is diffuse what is a dangerous racial divide that is building. When Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act of 1865, he was giving out pens in the White House. And as he was giving out the pens for signing the Voting Rights Act, he turned and said, "Keep this pen because this is the pen that signs the paper that assures that no Democratic candidate will ever again be reelected in the South." Because he understood that what would happen is that there would be a cultural and political realignment in the South in which the Democratic Party would be viewed as the black person's party and the Republican Party would be viewed as the white person's party. And that's exactly what's happened. When you look at the red states and you look at the voting down there and you see who's voting what, the blacks are voting for Democrats and the whites are voting for Republicans. That same realignment took place in 2008 and 2012 in our national politics. We now have the Democratic Party as the party of non-whites and the Republican Party as the party of whites. This is terribly dangerous. We do not want to, even if it's possible, as I chortle to myself, that the Republicans are so dumb that they are literally locking themselves into a situation where they're not going to be able to win a national election for the foreseeable future, because they have to appeal to non-whites in a country in which the demographics are changing. The only difference between what happened in the South and what happened in the North is there are more non-whites in the North. And so you can build a coalition that defeats the white person's party, and you can't build that same coalition in the South. So that we do not want to go down that road. That road for us as a culture, as a society, is a dreadful road that will end in tears. And my sense is that all of us who care about equality have to find ways not of sharpening the differences between the races, not of saying we have an affirmative action plan in which a black will triumph over a white, and the white will go away and feel terrible, and his family will feel terrible, and his community will feel terrible. I think is a path that we do not want to go down. Those of us who care about equality have to think and remember a little bit about the Second World War and the workforce. We have to recognize that true equality brings benefits to everybody. It is the efficiency that allows everybody to live better. And that if we are going to have a move, the difficult move, from formal to substantive equality, it has to be a move that makes the pie bigger for all of us. Thank you. Thank you. So our it's amazing how fast you can say our tradition. Our tradition now is that anybody who feels that they, you know, it's past time, you feel free to leave if you have something to do. If you want to stay, though, anyone who has questions, just come up to the mics and I'll try to respond to your questions.
Hi.
Hi, Sally. Back from Ohio, where she won the election for us.
I was wondering, you applauded Ruth Bader Ginsburg working to fight gender stereotypes by having laws overturned that were good for women on their face, but actually had these underlying stereotypes.
Well, they were stereotypical.
Right. So how do you distinguish that ethically or historically from arguments against affirmative action that are similar, that it's on its face good for blacks or women or anyone?
Oh, well,
but
I mean, your argument is a very good argument. The argument is, look, we had unequal laws. The unequal laws helped women in some situations, they helped men in some situation, and we set about dismantling them by saying stereotypical laws are terrible, whoever they happen to benefit at a particular time. So the question is, can't the same thing be said about the use of race? That ultimately the use of race as a criteria for giving away anything is so dangerous because it's so potentially inflammatory that we want to take it off the table. And the fact that blacks will be helped a little bit now, in the long run, they will not help. And so what we really should be going is to a colorblind world and that's a policy argument. That's a policy argument against affirmative action that people have to take very, very seriously. Will it in fact get us to substantive equality, or will it make life worse? Reasonable people, I think, can differ for that. My argument to you is that's a decision that the people should be allowed to make and not have the Republican Constitution make it for us.